listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris Knorr.
And me, Edward Gomez.
Let's start off with something I bet very few people have heard of. It's something called Amaterasu. Amaterasu, I think I pronounced that correctly. My apologies to anyone who pronounces better Japanese than me, which is probably quite a lot of people. This is not a galaxy, this is not a planet, this is not a moon, this is not a comet or an asteroid. This is a tiny subatomic particle that I guess is presumably now gone, having been detected. So this is a very big subatomic particle. That doesn't make any sense. A very high energy subatomic particle detected a few years ago, but published very recently.
Yeah, it was, I think, in 2021 that it was discovered by something called the Telescope Array, which is, it's an array, but it's not really a telescope. it's what you and I would call a detector. But it doesn't have optics that you can look through. It basically records particles that hit it. So this is a cosmic ray, which is some sort of subatomic particle, probably a proton, traveling very close to the speed of light, and is exceptionally high energy. I guess it was 30 years before, I think it was 1991, there was the Oh My God particle. Apologies for the offensive language, but that's really what it's called. That was about 50% more energetic than this one. Now, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to talk about the energy that they have because they use funny units, but it's 240 exa electron volts, which is 10 with 18 zeros electron volts. An electron volt is actually very small. But it's a handy way of measuring things when you're talking about individual particles. So that was 240, and the Oh My God particle was 320 of these extra electron volts. And it was discovered in Utah a couple of years ago. And it appears to be emanating from an area of space which doesn't have very much in it. Which isn't something to be worried about. The universe is supposed to be uniform and look the same in every direction, but that's statistical. You expect there to be areas where there's a little bit of higher density and a little bit of lower density, and this is a little bit of lower density. It just makes it a problem to tie in with where this is coming from.
It's this thing called the local void, which is an interesting name. I mean, the names of these things, the local void, is probably not too crazy. You mentioned this, the Oh My God particle. This has been called the What the Heck particle, I think by some. Because actually understanding what could have produced it. So you need something very, very energetic, something high energy, a high energy process to produce these kind of particles. Possibly things like the material around supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies that can accelerate, as you say, probably a proton or something up to very high speeds. You mentioned the energy is in these weird units. They've compared it to the energy of a golf ball traveling at 95 miles an hour, which I guess is that a typical golf ball speed? I'm not a golf player, but I can get that would hurt if a golf ball hit me at 95 miles an hour. And this is just one tiny subatomic particle, which is quite crazy to think of.
Yeah, and a single particle as well, not a cluster of them all traveling, a single particle. You think about other areas of astrophysics and, you know, you can't count individual photons terribly easily coming from something that's bright and energetic, because there's just too many of them, you couldn't give them all names, but in this case there is one, so it's handy to give it a name.
The official name for it is Amaterasu, as I mentioned at the start. So this is named after the sun goddess in Japanese mythology. So this second ever second most energetic particle detected. naming these particles, you say you can name them. So I think there were two neutrinos detected called Bert and Ernie after the Sesame Street characters. So they like to have a bit of fun with these things sometimes. I guess the one of the problems with this is there's one particle, it's been detected, which means it hit a detector and interacted with the detector and is now gone. I'm not sure what else there is to do with them trying to figure out how you make. I mean, these are statistical outliers, right? These are the most, probably the most energetic particles that are happen to have something happens that makes them go at these very, very high velocities. It's, as you say, it's not like there's billions of these things streaming through the universe. Well, there probably are.
That's right. Well, when it originated from its astrophysical source, there would have been a high number of them. But like you said, Chris, there's a full distribution of these energies that probably would have been shooting out through space. Either it may have been a focused beam, and this is just the one which was high enough energy to keep on course towards us, and wasn't deflected by other magnetic fields. It would have been deflected by the shape of the universe only, really.
Mm. Yeah, so then knowing how far it's travelled and so on is then very hard to pin down. But exciting to name individual particles. I guess you're in the field where you can name them. Then that's always maybe makes them feel more human. They're nothing like human, but maybe it personalizes the detections and makes them easier to talk about in some way. Okay, let's stick with things coming from afar. This is actually some of these high energetic events. We're used to detecting things like supernovae in galaxies and of all shapes and sizes. And one of the things that supernovae, exploding stars, do is they have an effect in most galaxies of kind of stopping star formation in its tracks, because they blast all of the gas and dust and other material out of the galaxy or clear it away and spread it out so it can't form more stars. And there's been some recent studies about small galaxies where that's not happening. Star formation is continuing. And it seems to be because of the nature of the gas and dust that's making them up, which has been studied. You're more on stellar evolution models than me. I isn't quite necessarily in your area, but what's going on here, Edward?
So these are, like you said, Chris, dwarf galaxies. So they're smaller versions of what we think of as being elliptical galaxies. So they're just large balls of gas, dust, and stars. But they're also low in one property, metallicity, which is an indicator of how many times they've been through the process of making stars. Is each time you make stars, you release, you bond elements together, and then these elements then propagate into the next generation of stars.
You kind of enrich the material, right, with heavier stuff, which then goes
exactly
on to form planets and dust and so on.
Yeah.
Later.
Yeah, and the very first stars would have been made out of just hydrogen and tiny amounts of other things that were available at the Big Bang, just after the Big Bang. And you know, you can see how stars then are the processes that create all of the elements, and there are little bits left over. So these dwarf galaxies are sort of pristine in some respects. They don't have very much of this other stuff because these elements don't travel very easily between galaxies unless they're interacting. So that's really relying on the galaxies to them to be made in the galaxies by the stars. These stars that are extremely massive being formed in dwarf galaxies, sort of when they come to the end of their life, they just implode. So there's no supernova that blows away the gas and the dust. And because of that, you end up with this environment that is still very friendly for star formation. So they have a longer period where they can form stars, before they start forming high mass stars that live very 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 fast, like supernovae, and then just blow them away. So some researchers have been looking at this, and that's their take on it.
Yeah, these supernovae that just collapse are something that we think of happening in very, very, very massive stars, but it's the fact that they're made of pristine stuff. They don't have still small amounts, but they don't have really any amount of heavy elements, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and iron, and so on in them. They're made, as you say, of this pristine stuff. And these are explosions that happen very, very quickly. These stars of this mass live for a few million years rather than a few billion years like stars like the mass of our sun do. So this is very very early on in the process. And I guess it's trying to explain these star formation rates, because you would expect, naively, one would expect smaller galaxies to form stars more slowly, I guess, because there's less stuff there. They probably have fewer high density environments and so on. And this just shows that actually that those high density environments stay high denser for longer.
And it's probably what the early galaxies were doing, this type of thing when they didn't have the older generation, the first generation of stars, which is something quite alien to us. We can't look at that in the local universe.
Yeah, we can only study that in the very distant universe, of course, and see pinpricks of light rather than nice pictures of galaxies. You're right, these dwarf galaxies do provide a little bit of an insight into what went on before. Okay, so studies of massive stars in other galaxies, these dwarf galaxies. Let's stick with dwarf galaxies, a very nearby one, the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is one of the nearest galaxies to us. It's only about 160,000 light years away, so it's on our astronomical doorstep. But it is still another galaxy, and for the first time, astronomers have found an image of or made a detection of a disk around a star in that other galaxy, which is this is a disk of material going around the star that will eventually form planets. That's quite an achievement to do it in, albeit a nearby galaxy, but still another galaxy, 160,000 light years away.
It is relatively close, but it's still another galaxy. It has different properties to our Milky Way galaxy. Like we were saying with dwarf galaxies, you've got a different chemical makeup of the as a whole of the galaxy, although it's very, very close to our Milky Way. And the thought that we can see a star forming from a with its protoplanetary disk and is really quite phenomenal that that technology has moved on so much that it's allowing this to happen.
This is the detection made with a collaboration of two telescopes down in Chile. So the very large telescope, which has on it a detector called MUSE, which does have a name, the Multi-Unit Spectroscopic Explorer. But all that means is that it can study lots of objects and look at their spectrum. It can spread the light out into its wavelengths and study whether this light is brighter in, say, the blue or the red, or where it's brightest. And that tells you something about the speed at which this stuff is moving. If it's moving away from you, it looks slightly redder. If it's moving towards you, it looks slightly bluer. And they've done that with this star. They found some jets of material. It's something called a Herbig-Haro object, named after the astronomers who were cataloguing these in the 20th century. I actually did my undergraduate project on the Herbig-Haro objects when I was in my third year. So these they found these jets of materials spewing out from the poles of this system, from the star's poles. But then the ALMA telescope, so the Atacama Large Millimeter and Submillimeter Array, which measures much longer wavelength light, has looked in huge detail. This telescope covers tens of kilometers in diameter. It's an array of telescopes in Chile. It's absolutely massive, and that's looked at the objects in the center and seen that there is, again, appears to be stuff on a much smaller scale. Some stuff moving away and some stuff moving towards us in a pattern that resembles a rotating disk. So we've not got a picture of the disk. There's an artist's impression of it, of course, but we've got the clear detection that there's material moving towards and away from us, rotating around this star, which, as I say, is quite an achievement to do 160,000 light years distance. And the pictures as well. I mean, although the actual detection is some red and blue splodgers on a on a picture. The artist's impression is amazing, but also that region of space is quite stunning as well. I mean, there's a lot of this amazing nebulae and star forming regions in the Large Magellanic Cloud. So the pictures are very pretty to look at as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's it really is quite wonderful, and it's I think the object is recent. Well, it's sort of the gas has a dust cloud around it, which has just become transparent enough to be able to view the object inside around it. So it's also, you know, in astronomy we're looking for things. There are catalogues that collect things that are similar together, and we're always looking for the things that are different or the gaps in catalogues. And this is almost a gap, catching something in this very brief period where it's forming.
And actually, as we said, like the previous story, having that more pristine material means that there's not as much gas and there's not dust there, particularly these heavy elements that form dust clouds. And that does make it a little bit easier to peer through and see what's going on in the center. So again, this dwarf galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud, is becoming a bit of an interesting sort of experimental site for astronomers to stare at for these things. Okay. So away from sort of astronomical science onto space flight, there was in November the second attempt at launching SpaceX's Starship. This is this rocket powered by, is it 30-odd massive engines at the base of it that forms this enormous rocket. They did try this a few months ago. It launched off the ground, and then the booster didn't separate from the second stage, and then the whole thing exploded very dramatically, which is often what happens with the first test flight. No people on board, I should say. This one was slightly more successful in that it got the booster separated from the main rocket, and the second stage carried on. The booster was going to come down. I think it was going to crash in the space. I'm not sure if it was planning to land or not. But it did not. It all went a bit wrong from there on.
Yeah. And this. So we should say that it is quite expected that things will go wrong when you're testing rockets like this, because you can't test them frequently, and it's extremely expensive and requires, they normally only have one or two that are currently working models, and then it takes a huge amount of effort to reconstruct a new one. And they lost the first one, it exploded. So there's a hiatus of 6 months while they got, their second production one in order.
Issues that they had, right? They could identify what went wrong, what stopped them separating, make sure those bits don't fail.
Interesting engineering feat because it is a steerable rocket. It's got 30, like you said, 30 something. I can't remember the number off the top of my head. These Raptor engines at the back, and they can be moved, so you can change the change the flight path of it quite a lot to correct for atmospheric and for other things, which when you compare it to the Saturn V rocket, which is the rocket which took the Apollo missions to the moon, that it only I think had five engines.
Five, I think. Yeah.
And you know, when you compare that to 30, they're obviously much bigger, but there's very little that you can do with five engines. You don't have as much fine control. And it was, you know, in the 60s, and quite a lot of the technology has moved on. Mm. I don't really like SpaceX because it's owned and run by Elon Musk, who is dysfunctional and not very nice to his staff and a lot of other people. But I do want this to succeed, because it's really what NASA is pinning all their hopes for, the Artemis mission, which is the next crewed mission to the moon. Which they're still saying will be in a few years, but I think it's going to be at least the 2030s.
Yeah, I'm skeptical of the idea of getting onto the moon this side of 2030. I mean, maybe I'll be proved wrong, but that seems ambitious. I mean, these private companies can move faster than, say, NASA can. There are fewer, I don't know about fewer checks and balances, because they still have to obey sort of safety rules and so on. But there's a bit more of a, as you say, not treating staff very nice. There's a bit more of a pressure on the staff to, you know, a lot of burnout and so on from people working on it, as at least reported, which isn't necessarily isn't a good thing if that's the case. But in terms of a project, it's as you say, it's something that is required to get people to the moon and then other things to Mars. There's lots of companies that are basically booking flights for the future. I hope they've got, well, I guess you don't really insure these things. I don't think you can insure these things. I hope their financial backers are aware of the risks involved, because it is quite dangerous. So that's massive rockets that in the future will take people onto the moon and Mars is the plan. So that's it for this month. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.